Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. You will hear stories from Jonathan Evans and Ashley Thompson. Then, listen for our education report and the making of a nation. But first, this report.
The United States is adding Pakistan to its list of nations that have taken part in or permitted systemic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a statement Tuesday that he added Pakistan to the U.S. list of countries of particular concern. The State Department is required by U.S. law to rate religious freedom by country every year. Human rights defenders have long voiced concern about Pakistan's treatment of religious minorities, including Shiites, Ahmadis, and Christians. The country had earlier been on a U.S. special watch list for religious freedom. The action Tuesday means that Pakistan could become a target of U.S. sanctions. However, such measures have generally been ignored in the past. China, Eritrea, Iran, Myanmar, and North Korea all appear on the new list of countries of particular concern. Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan are also named. All of the countries were also named on the list last year. Uzbekistan had formally been named a country of particular concern, but Pompeo moved it to the special watch list this year. The watch list now also includes the Comoros Islands and Russia. Pompeo also named several Islamic militant groups as entities of particular concern, as they do not meet the definition of countries. The groups are the Al-Nusra Front in Syria, Somalia's Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram in West Africa, Yemen's Houthi rebels, the Islamic State, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In far too many places across the globe, individuals continue to face harassment, arrests, or even death for simply living their lives in accordance with their beliefs, Pompeo said. The United States will not stand by as spectators in the face of such oppression. I'm Ana Mateo.
The art of building small wooden boats is being used to help young, at-risk adults in the United States. These young men and women are being trained and working as apprentices in a boat building program in Alexandria, Virginia. The Alexandria Seaport Foundation is providing support for the program, which serves the Washington, D.C. area. It aims to help those who have little hope of attending college or finding a good-paying job. The goal is to give young people the skills, state of mind, and self-control to change their lives for the better. The year-round program teaches small groups of people how to build small wooden sailboats and canoes. The apprentices are from 18 to 22 years old. One apprentice is 19-year-old Chris Adkins from Florida. He is learning what it takes to build boats that are beautiful and useful with hammers, saws, and other tools. It's been fun to learn how to use these tools, he said. Jimmy Gottfried is the head of the boat building program. He once served as a boat building apprentice.
Many of the apprentices in our program have faced many challenges in their life, such as lack of family support, dropping out of school, having run-ins with the law, and they're looking for a way to gain back the confidence they need to go back out into the workforce.
The apprentices are guided by volunteers who teach them how to build the boats, as well as guide the young people in their personal lives. Some of the apprentices have yet to finish high school. The Alexandria Seaport Foundation works to help them prepare for and pass a series of tests called the GED. Passing the GED is comparable to having completed high school. Apprentices who struggle with mathematics receive help from a volunteer teacher. Adkins says he was a good student in high school, but he had to leave school to work because of family issues.
My mom died when I was 8 years old, so that's always something that's on me. And one reason that I came to the program was because they want to help you. I'm not used to someone wanting to help me or enthusiastic about it.
Jay Helinski completed the program about 1 year ago. He speaks of his own experiences as a model for the group.
And they know that I'm living proof of what hard work, dedication, and just the willpower to succeed gets you to.
Adkins is now more than halfway through his apprenticeship. He says he feels better about himself. He has passed his high school equivalency and hopes to go to college one day. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody is now the most streamed song from the 20th century. The 1975 song has been streamed over 1.6 billion times worldwide, the record company Universal Music Group said this week. Bohemian Rhapsody is long, energetic, and operatic, and one of Queen's most famous songs. The song's popularity has risen thanks to the new Bohemian Rhapsody movie. In the 5 weeks since its release, the film has already earned more than $600 million in ticket sales worldwide. It has also helped bring the music of the British rock band to a new generation. The film stars Rami Malek as lead Queen singer Freddie Mercury, who died in 1991. Malek was nominated for a Golden Globe last week for his performance and is widely expected to get an Oscar nomination in January. I'm Ashley Thompson.
A new study of American teachers suggests that there is a major shortage of computer science training in U.S. schools. The study, released last week, was a joint effort between American technology company Microsoft and the international research company YouGov. The study asked more than 500 K-12 educators across the U.S. a series of questions about classroom training for computer science and coding skills. The study found that 88% of teachers agreed that computer science is very important to a person's future success in the workplace. Microsoft noted a U.S. government prediction that by 2020, there will be 1.4 million computer science-related jobs available. However, U.S. college graduates are expected to take less than 33% of those jobs. The company also estimated that 10 years from now, 77% of jobs in the U.S. workforce will require technology-related skills. Microsoft says that currently, only about 40% of U.S. schools offer computer science classes that include computer programming. The company said that a shortage of teachers with the necessary skills is also a major concern. In the study, 30% of teachers said they felt underqualified in their ability to help prepare students for a future in computer science or coding. Another 20% said they felt overwhelmed with that responsibility. In addition, 25% of the teachers said computer science was not a subject their students are currently tested on. And about 20% said the subject was not taught in their classrooms at all. The most common reason given by teachers for the low level of computer science training is a lack of government money to pay for such programs. About 30% blamed a lack of funding for why schools are not providing more technology-related learning. Mark Sparvel is head of education marketing for Microsoft. He said the study's results show that teachers believe computer science education is in high demand in the classroom. Teachers see it as a priority. Parents see it as a priority from previous research, Sparvel said. And yet, it's in low supply. The study found that 83% of teachers believe computer coding can build a student's overall creativity. In addition, 80% of educators said they believe large technology companies like Microsoft, Google, and Apple should be helping schools teach students computer science skills. About 75% of the teachers said they were concerned that the government is not doing enough to help teachers to build these skills. Microsoft said it has expanded its cooperation with school systems in recent years to help improve computer science education. One of its programs is called TEALS, or Technology Education and Literacy in Schools. This program places trained computer science professionals in high school classrooms in the U.S. and Canada. The goal is to train teachers in computer science-related subjects. Microsoft announced last week it was providing $10 million to increase computer coding in schools. That money will go to an organization called Code.org. The not-for-profit group, based in Seattle, Washington, supports expanding computer science learning in U.S. schools. The group says it especially seeks to increase interest in computer science and coding among females, minority groups, and poor students. The Microsoft study followed a recent announcement by Amazon. The big online seller said that it was launching a new effort aimed at teaching more than 10 million students a year how to code. I'm Brian Lynn.
Next, our American history series, The Making of a Nation.
As president, John Adams was head of the Federalist Party, but the power of that position really belonged to former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. For this and other reasons, Adams did not like Hamilton. He said he would rather be a minister to Europe under Jefferson than a president controlled by Hamilton. Hamilton did not like Adams either. Hamilton did everything he could to block Adams from becoming president again. He gave his support to another Federalist candidate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Under the electoral system at that time, the candidate with the most votes became president. The candidate with the second highest number of votes became vice president. A Federalist victory in the election of 1800 would not be easy. The Republicans had a very strong and popular candidate in Thomas Jefferson. So Federalist Party leaders attempted to change the electoral system. The Constitution said state legislatures were to choose electors to vote for president. The Federalists tried to gain control over the legislature's decisions. They wanted Congress to create a special committee to rule if an elector had or did not have the right to vote. The committee could say if an elector's vote should be counted or thrown away. The committee would have 6 members from the Senate and 6 members from the House of Representatives. The 13th member would be the Chief Justice of the United States. Creating such a committee violated the Constitution. Federalist leaders knew this, so they wanted Congress to approve the committee, but keep the measure secret until after the election. The Federalists held a majority of seats in the Senate, and the Senate voted to approve the proposal. But some Federalist members of the House of Representatives denounced it. They made many changes in the proposal. The Senate refused to accept the changes. Without agreement by both houses of Congress, the bill died. Federalist leaders saw their hopes for an election victory begin to disappear. By the summer of 1800, Thomas Jefferson's Republican Party had strong leaders in every state. It had many newspapers to express party ideas. Jefferson decided to take a holiday at Monticello, his farm in Virginia. The Republican Party leader in New York was a lawyer, Aaron Burr. Burr had served as an officer under General George Washington during America's War for Independence from Britain. After the war, he joined the Federalist Party and was elected to the United States Senate. Later, he changed parties and became a Republican. In 1800, a group of both Federalists and Republicans supported him as a candidate for president. Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton were bitter enemies. When Hamilton learned of his own party's support for electing Burr, his reaction was quick and sharp. "Anybody," he said, "even Thomas Jefferson, is better than Aaron Burr. Jefferson is not dangerous. Burr is. Jefferson's ideas of government are wrong, but at least he is an honest man. Burr is a man without honesty and character. He will destroy America," Hamilton said. The president elected in 1800 would govern from a new capital city. The national government would move from Philadelphia to Washington, a newly built city in the District of Columbia. It was along the Potomac River between the states of Maryland and Virginia. When President Adams and his wife Abigail arrived in Washington, they found a frontier town. There were few houses or streets. Mrs. Adams could not believe what she saw. She wrote to her daughter, "This is a city only because we call it a city. Our house here is very big, but the rooms are not finished. There is almost no furniture. There are not enough lamps for light." John Adams also wrote to his wife about the house where the president would live. In a letter, he asked heaven to bless the house and whoever lived in it. A later president asked for Adams' blessing to be carved above a fireplace.
There is a mantle there with an inscription from John Adams saying, "May all future residents of this house be virtuous creatures."
Joseph Ellis is a historian and the author of many books about America's founding fathers. He says John Adams' words can still be found in the White House today. A street called Pennsylvania Avenue went from the president's house to the Capitol building where Congress would meet. On each side of the street, where buildings stand today, there were fields of mud. This was the new federal city, the new capital of the United States. This was where the winner of the presidential election of 1800 would begin his term of office. John Ferling taught American history at the University of West Georgia. He says Jefferson's party campaigned better and listened to the concerns of ordinary people.
The Republicans, the Jeffersonians, understood the American political process, the more democratic process that was coming into being, better than the Federalists did, and it enabled them to win a couple of key states, and that spelled doom for Adams.
George Washington won America's first two presidential elections without opposition. John Adams won the third presidential election by 3 electoral votes. This time, in 1800, there was no clear winner. When the electors' votes were counted, President Adams had 65 votes. But Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each had 73 votes. So under the Constitution, the House of Representatives would have to choose between Jefferson and Burr, the candidates with the highest number of votes. Each congressman could vote, but each state had just one vote. That vote would go to the candidate supported by a majority of congressmen from the state. A candidate had to receive a majority of the state votes to win. In 1800, that meant 9 of the 16 states. The Federalists saw the situation as their last chance to control the presidency. They had two plans. They would try to block the Congress from electing either Jefferson or Burr as president. Then they would try to find a way to put executive power in the hands of a Federalist. If that plan failed, they were prepared to elect Burr. The Federalists tried to make people believe that Burr was working with them against Jefferson. Burr denied this. In a letter to Jefferson, Burr wrote, "Every Republican wants you to be president of the United States. Every good Republican wants to serve under you. I would be happy and honored to be your vice president. And if you believe I could help you better in some other position, I would do so." On February 11th, the House of Representatives began to count votes state by state. 8 states chose Jefferson. 6 chose Burr. The representatives of 2 states, Maryland and Vermont, gave each man an equal number of votes. There was no majority within those states, so neither man won the votes of those states. The voting continued. All that day and throughout the night, the representatives voted. 27 times, the count remained the same. 8 states for Jefferson, 6 for Burr, 2 undecided. The next morning, the representatives decided to rest for 4 hours. The voting began again at noon. There was no change. The 13th of February passed, then the 14th and 15th. Still no change. The House voted 33 times. It could not elect a president. A change in the vote of just one congressman from Maryland or Vermont could decide the contest. Later, after the election, the representative from Delaware said he had met with 2 congressmen from Maryland and 1 from Vermont. All were Federalists. All had voted for Aaron Burr. The Delaware congressman said they claimed they spoke with a friend of Thomas Jefferson. He said they told Jefferson's friend they would change their votes if Jefferson made certain promises. Jefferson denied that he had made any political promises. He said many men tried to get promises from him, but he said he told all of them that he would never become president with his hands tied. The House of Representatives voted for the 36th time on February 17th. 10 states, including Maryland and Vermont, voted for Thomas Jefferson. 4 states voted for Aaron Burr. 2 states, Delaware and South Carolina, did not vote. But Jefferson had the majority he needed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program on the Voice of America.